Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Bayman Review Podcast, Season 2, Episode 5. I can't believe that we're already 5 episodes in. That's crazy to me. I feel like just yesterday we started Season 2. And today I'm very, very happy to be hosting, you know, I would say an OG Bayman Review Podcast guest, Sara Al-Abid. Hi, Sara. How are you?
Hi. I'm really good. How are you?
I'm good. It's
lovely to be back.
I'm so excited to be tackling the Happiness Institute with you today. But before we dive into that, I just want to reintroduce our podcast like we do every time. Mm-hmm. It's a podcast where we tackle issues ranging from life hacks to politics to government and MUN tips. I'm going to miss saying this. And like I said, today we're going to be talking about the Happiness Institute and what type of research you do there and what you're involved in, etc. So I'm really excited to hear what you have to say. Before I let you introduce yourself to maybe some of our new listeners, I just want to say my name is Hayo. I'm this year's Undersecretary General of Marketing, Design, and Production. And with me is Sara Al-Abid, our Director General this year. So, Sara, the floor is yours to introduce yourself, and we'll dive right into the questions when you're done.
Thanks a bunch, Hayo. So, it's lovely to be with you on the Bayman Review. I've been here before. It's lovely every time. And so I'm this year's Director General of Bayman. I also serve in a few other capacities at the AB community and within the clubs and societies that I think is a big part of who I am and what I do in terms of my extracurriculars. But mm-hmm. of course, as some of us do and as some of us hope to do at some point, we also run these schizophrenic side careers, if you will. So despite, of course, working a lot at AUB with Model United Nations and diplomacy and politics and things like that, my work right now in terms of career is quite different. So yes, I work in journalism, for example, but I also work at the Happiness Research Institute, where I'm a researcher mm-hmm. right now, which is very different from what we do at Bayman. Mm-hmm. But many of the values are kind of the same, I would say.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So I'm glad that you mentioned that, because my first question is about the Happiness Research Institute. And can you tell us a little bit about what they do, who they are? Because I have never heard about them until I knew that you assumed a job there and you started your research there. So it's really cool and interesting to get to hear your side and your perspective on the matter.
Mm-hmm. So the Happiness Research Institute is a think tank, and mm-hmm. they work on, as the title would suggest, happiness and well-being, and tackles it from a data-driven perspective. So it's not so much psychology and mental health and aspects like that, as much as it's those topics of happiness that we often consider tackled with data-driven research and analyses of that sort. So the Institute is led by its CEO, Mike Viking, who's also perhaps, you would know, the author of a few books that actually have been quite popular in Beirut and in Lebanon. The Little Book of Hygge, The Little Book of Lüge, and all these books that talk about the things that happen in Scandinavia, but also beyond Scandinavia, that make the Nordic countries the happiest countries in the world year mm-hmm. on year again. So he does a phenomenal job leading the institute. It's a smaller institute, so it's a think tank. We're under 10 people, but the work we produce is phenomenal. So we're working with companies like Microsoft, also with companies like, or rather organizations like the Nordic Council of Ministers. And we've also worked with a bunch of other stakeholders, but it's at the core of everything, it's data. And how
that's
to
so interesting, to analyze
actually.
It.
Yeah.
Nice. And why did you decide to join the Institute? Like, you could have chosen any other place to intern or work mm-hmm. at, but you chose this place.
Yeah. So as a Danish person myself, mm-hmm. I had known about the Institute for a while, just because when I got into my degree, I knew I wanted to go into research in some capacity. And so, you know, I did a bit of my mapping. So what kind of think tanks are in Denmark? Same I did in Lebanon, you know, what kind of mm-hmm. think tanks are in Lebanon, etc. Mm-hmm. And the Happiness Research Institute definitely stood out to me. But it wasn't until they had an opening that I really began to consider, okay, maybe I don't want to just have them part of my mapping. Perhaps I want to consider seeing what it's like there, because it's so different mm-hmm. from anything I've ever done academically. Mm-hmm. You may know or you may not know, my academic background and my research background is conflict, peace, and security. It's a really rough area that's quite depressing, especially that my focus is on the MENA region. So to go from A to Z in that regard was something that was quite appealing to me, and I wanted to see what that felt like, I guess. So that's kind of how I got into it. Yeah,
I like that you decided to take on that challenge. And now, can you tell us a little bit about your role at the Institute and what kind of research you're involved in currently?
Yeah, so I'm a researcher on a shorter term for right now. And I'm involved with two major projects at the Institute. So the first one is a research report that we're doing for the Nordic Council of Ministers, which is basically the United Nations, but only of the Nordic countries. So it's Finland, Sweden, Iceland, Denmark, Norway, Faroe Islands, and a few other places. Okay. And they basically lead those countries in terms of how foreign policy should look like, how national policies should look like, and making sure that it's very comprehensive. Now, what's interesting about this project is that we're actually working on something called a well-being economy. And for those of you that haven't heard about a well-being economy, it's this concept that says GDP, especially after the 2008 financial crisis, cannot measure our development anymore. It leaves out so many things. It doesn't consider education or happiness or well-being or all these more subjective things. Mm-hmm. And so a well-being economy says, you know what, we need to start measuring different things about our country in order to see if we're developing in the right direction. These things can be gender equality, satisfaction with life, happiness, all these different things. So we're looking at, well, how can governments in the Nordic region actually make that switch and begin to perhaps move away from GDP, which I think is so crazy because it's nothing I had ever thought of before, to be honest. I was just like, okay, well, that's the economic system. What are you going to do about it, you know?
Mm-hmm. And this is what we've been taught our whole lives.
That's just the way it is. Especially because I don't come from an economics background. To me, this was like the newest news I'd ever heard. And the second project I'm involved in is the Happiness Museum that we actually have. So a lot of people apparently in the last 5 years or so of the Institute's history was like, hey, I want to come visit the Institute because I'm sure there's like ice cream and puppies and like happy people and like parties and things like that. And then they were like, yeah, but like it's really just a bunch of people sitting on their laptops like crunching numbers and analyzing. So they decided, you know what, why don't we turn our research and turn happiness research in general into like an exhibition, into a museum. So I'm involved with that project right now, and it's really great.
Wow, that's really cool. I would love to delve into the details of all of those types of projects that you're on, but before we do that, or until we do that, you know, I know one thing about you is you're very interested in policy making, and it's the, you know, the first time I heard this type of term is from you, actually. And kind of what we can derive from what you've said already is that being happy is not a result of just feeling. It's not just a feeling. It's not just a consequence of what we do in our daily lives. It's also a result of the environment that we're in. It's a culmination of factors that are related to politics and policies and economics, etc. So why is it important to study such factors? It goes back to what you said about switching, making the switch from focusing on GDP as a measure to other measures as well. So why is it important to consider these factors now, and why are we making this shift today, even though it's just happening in the Nordic countries, but I'm sure that they're becoming a benchmark for future governments to take on as well, and summarize these results as well in a report, in a happiness report that's published officially and people read and people analyze. So
I think it's so important because at the end of the day, governments are, or should be, one could say, hardworking and serving their people. And in order to serve your people and be hardworking, you need to be efficient. And I think it's a shame to spend so many years and so much time on policies that at the end of the day don't consider, for example, happiness and well-being. Because at the end of the day, a government is supposed to serve its people. And part of serving, and this is something that if you go back to Aristotle and philosophers from the early days said, the whole point of living is well-being and happiness. So if policies and governments and institutions are not able to bring that happiness on the table, then they're kind of wasting their own time. So that's why this type of research, I think, is so important, because it says, hello, can we just like remember the reason we're doing this in the first place? And it kind of just rings that bell at the back of your head saying, reminder, there's a bigger picture here to why we're doing these policies. And of course, yeah, that's why it needs to be so interdisciplinary. That's why it needs to consider politics, economics, law, and all these different factors, because at the end of the day, those are the foundations of our society. And those are the things that influence us. But you say, for example, that the Nordic countries have begun, yes, to make that realization, also because they had a welfare system very early on, most of them, which kind of is very similar. But in our region, in the MENA region, for example, you have in the UAE, a few years back, they established the Ministry of Happiness. And there's a lot of these initiatives around the world that are beginning to realize, well, if we invest in happiness, we're saving a lot. And I think that's what's really important about these reports that we do, because it helps a lot of stakeholders make that transition.
I love that. I love that. One of the, I think, screenshots from, I think, the report or anything like that that you sent me, there was a quote, a sentence that really captured my attention. It's not only about the wealth we accumulate, it's so can you elaborate on this notion when it comes to determining who the happiest countries in the world are? Obviously, I would say the Nordic countries are some of the happiest countries. But this sentence holds so much power and importance. So if you can like break it down for us, and I feel like you've done that already, but more so elaborate on the power of policy making and making in rendering a population happy.
So there's two kind of big factors, I think, to consider. The first one is obviously wealth and wealthy countries. And that kind of goes back to GDP and what we were talking about a bit earlier on. So if you look at GDP and happiness, and as GDP increases, and then looking at when happiness increases, some countries exhibit that this isn't in parallel. So for example, the United States perhaps actually has more of a higher GDP than most of the Nordic countries, but does not exhibit or present higher happiness levels. Whereas some of the Nordic countries, the opposite is true. So the key here is to understand that wealth does play a role, but it's not all that there is. It's not the only thing that there is. And there's a quote I've heard a few times now at the Institute by Kanye West, which actually says, having money isn't everything, but not having it is. And that's what really makes the difference for a lot of countries, because a lot of the lower income countries, countries of the global south, etc., who struggle in terms of GDP and perhaps struggle in terms of growing, booming economies or even sustainable economies, it's those countries that when they don't have the capabilities of the more Western or more Nordic countries, they then perhaps can't experience happiness at the same levels. But a lot of these are also proven wrong. There's a lot of countries, for example, that show that their happiness levels are actually so at all in parallel to their very low GDP levels. And this is also a big phenomenon that we see. So you have to think about it both ways. Of course, wealth plays a big role, because if you have wealth, you don't have to think about, well, do I have food on my table? Can I send my kids to school? Can I, et cetera, et cetera. But that doesn't necessarily guarantee that you're not going to be unhappy. And the same goes. So if you are unable to put food on the table, you're unable to send your kids to school, it does not guarantee that you're going to be unhappy.
Wow, that's such an interesting way of looking at it. There's such a, like, I didn't know that there's a science to happiness and breaking it down this way. Because like you take for granted, always say like, you know, if you have a roof to live under and you have food on the table and you have whatever, you have all the blessings in the world, you should take it for granted that you should be happy, you should be thankful, etc. So who knew that there were so many factors that also affect the way that we are go about our mm-hmm. days, whether we are happy or sad or mm-hmm. whatever mental state we choose to be in. Mm-hmm. There was another interesting thing that captured my attention in one of the reports you sent me, which is about the lost wallet experiment. Would mm-hmm. you like to elaborate about that? Because I found it to be very interesting. Yeah.
So the lost wallet experiment is basically trying to measure trustworthiness. So mm-hmm. it's an experiment that's performed where researchers systematically leave a wallet with a certain value in certain places across the world, and then leave mm-hmm. another wallet with no value in it in the similar places, and then try to understand, well, in what circumstances, in what countries, in what contexts is this wallet returned? And in what circumstances does it not return? And mm-hmm. the idea here is that, of course, the further times it's returned, the higher the trust levels are, because people sympathize with the person that's lost their wallet, and people also can lose their wallet without immediately having to fear that their money is gone, their cards are gone, their social mm-hmm. security cards, etc. So mm-hmm. this is kind of what the experiment goes about. It was conducted in 2019, and it was actually done by a group of economists. So again, this is one of those examples similar to the Institute, where you really see that there's so much interest in people from really different fields in understanding trust, happiness, all these things. But essentially what happened is that in the Nordic countries, as well as Switzerland and a few other places, the amount of times that the wallets were returned, both with and without money, were extremely high. In comparison to, for example, China, where it was the lowest.
Oh, okay.
And this experiment kind of goes to show that trust levels in the Nordic countries are so high, whereas in more, not even underdeveloped countries, but in countries where the circumstances are very different and the culture is very different and happiness levels are very different, the wallets went missing, you could say. Mm-hmm. And I think to build on this, I'll give you an example. So I grew up here in Denmark. And when I was a kid, say that my family was going out on a Sunday for lunch, etc. But, you know, I need a nap. What you do in Denmark typically is that you put your kids in a stroller and you put the stroller out on the street, in the middle of the street, and you leave them there, unlocked. Napping while you sit inside in a restaurant for 2-3 hours, you do your thing, they nap outside, it's fine.
With your child outside.
With your child outside in the middle of a busy street, it's completely fine. And again, this also goes to showcase just trust levels, because there's no one that ever considers, oh my God, can something happen to my child? No, because if something happens, then someone else is going to help you. There is that mm-hmm. sense of trust in a very different way. Mm-hmm. And that's also something that's very apparent of the Nordic countries. There was a case in, I believe it was the 70s or the 60s actually, where a Danish woman was living in New York and she got a child. And so one day she was going in to grab her cup of coffee. And so she didn't want to bring the stroller inside and everything. So she left her child in the stroller. He was napping outside the coffee store, went in, got her coffee, and came out only to be arrested for child negligence. She had to explain, you know, this is very normal in the Nordic countries, we do this, and etc. And she served mm-hmm. in prison for it.
So
this is the type of research we try to understand why, and this is where laws come in place and politics come mm-hmm. in place, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Do we shape our laws and politics and thus our happiness and how we treat each other, or is it really the other way around?
Mm-hmm. That's such an interesting question to pose, especially in times like now, like unprecedented times where we are mm-hmm. stuck at home, and like mm-hmm. COVID just swept us away and it was so unexpected. So the fact that this type of research is being done, and I hope that it's something that we will see soon enough in the next few years in the MENA region. And like you said, we're already starting to see it mm-hmm. in the UAE. And I think Saudi Arabia is starting to implement something or a version of its own. My final question to you here today, where do you see us headed in the MENA region, not just in the Nordic countries, because I feel like they're doing so well. Bravo to them. But us in the MENA region, when it comes to happiness, we still don't know what that means. There's still a lot mm-hmm. of interference with religion and a lot of, I would say, political turmoil that affects us. Yeah. So, yeah, where do you feel like we're headed in terms of adopting such policies or adopting such research and starting to implement it in our own governments?
I think there needs to be, of course, a certain level of basic necessities that's covered, especially right now with Lebanon. Mm-hmm. Because you can't begin to say, well, some of the research we find, for example, is that when people commute less to work, they're happier. So what is one solution?
I can tell you for a fact, my dad is happier. Like, yeah. He doesn't go to work in person.
Exactly. So for example, yeah. one solution to increase happiness is establish better public transport systems so that people mm-hmm. can easier commute. Things like this is not really feasible for Lebanon right now, because we're talking about commuting to work while a lot of people don't have work. We're talking mm-hmm. about commuting to stores when a lot of people can't afford to go to the stores. So because of that, it's a bit of a tricky thing. But at the same time, there really is not ever going to be a place that is the right place, the right time. This is the perfect fit. Now is the time to move, you know. Mm-hmm. But there needs to be consideration for it. So one way that you can do that is similar to what you do in a well-being economy. A big part of the well-being economy is just trying to figure out, well, how happy is the country? How well is the country? And then gather that info through years. Understand the trends. Right now in 2020, we were this happy about these things in life. Next year, mm-hmm. we're this happy about these things in life.
Our priorities are always shifting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then once you have that as data, policymakers can say, actually, when we look at the data, now we can tell that people are so unhappy with public spaces. So an easy way to increase happiness and well-being would be to focus on establishing well-working public spaces. Because the way it right now is in Lebanon is it's just, yeah, minisama is a vadi.
Yeah.
You know, it's just based of public
word of mouth. Yeah.
Public opinion, public interest, right? So if a certain politician knows that their certain sect is interested in one certain thing that they're going for, whereas if we had these types of indicators and we have this type of knowledge, it would be crystal clear. 80% of the population is extremely unhappy about the level of education. Shulhal, let us fix the level of education. Let us fix, etc., mm-hmm. etc. So this is really something that Lebanon can do. I'm going to say it in Arabic. It really doesn't require all that much. It's a matter of collecting data. We do this in Lebanon all the time. UNESCO collects data. UNDP collects data. Lebanon collects data. Collect data on something that can inform policymaking. So this is something we can do in Lebanon. But what is, of course, sad is what Lebanese can do and that Lebanese aren't doing. And this is the same kind of with COVID. There was so much about COVID that was in our hands. Staying home, social distancing, wearing masks, caring for one another. All those things were things that were in our hands, but we just decided that we did not want to abide by them. And it kind of goes similarly when it comes to happiness. So the World Happiness Report, which is published every single year by the United Nations, ranked Lebanon really, really low this year, the lowest we've ever been. We were actually ranked, if I'm not mistaken, at 123. Mm-hmm. And a big reason for that, and a big factor that was considered when Lebanon got this ranking, was that one of the factors for establishing the ranking is levels of generosity. And the levels of generosity in Lebanon had gone down in 2020 so much that it was actually what drove us so low on this ranking. And generosity is something that is within our hands. It doesn't necessarily mean that we need to, you know, be the type of Lebanese people that at every single restaurant is like, la ana bidfa. You know, it doesn't need to be that type of generosity, mm-hmm. but the type of generosity, I'll lend a hand when I can. I'll help out in my building, sad in my neighborhood, all these things. That type of generosity went down so much. And it also shows, and research shows, that generosity in itself can create so much happiness in a population. So I think on an end of a last note, I know we're nearing the end, maybe this is something to consider. And, you know, there's a lot of things politically, they're not in our hands. We can't do much. Mm-hmm. But generosity is in our hands, as cliche as it sounds. And scientifically, it can increase our happiness.
Who knew? I'm learning a lot from you, Sara, and I love that. And, you know, these learnings are so simple. Like, these solutions are there, and we have the solution.
Mm-hmm.
We just need people to want to implement them, to see a reason to implement them, not just blinded by the fact that, oh, my people are having their own problems, so I have to solve their problems. No, like, you have millions of other people, not just a specific percentage of the population who needs help. So I hope that our amazing listeners will take that into consideration and, you know, just be more generous, be more kind, be kinder, and you might be part of the change that we witness next year, maybe, inshallah, with our happiness ranking as a country, who knows. And once again, thank you, Sara, for joining us. It's always, always a pleasure. And tune in to next week's episode, guys.
Thank you so much, Haya. It was so nice to be here. Bye.